What we're going to be talking about is making changes in our own lives while still having a life and still being ourselves. And we're going to be using Ruth as a model. Okay, so the first thing we have to do is to really identify what we mean conceptually when we use the word self. People say, I want to be me. Well, who's me? So Rambam gives us a basis upon which we could answer this question. He says that there are five things that make one person different from another. Here are the five things. The first is who they are physically. So when you answer that question, that means male, female, born into this century, that century, this height, that weight, this energy level. Now, who you are physically affects everything else. In earlier times, if you go back, let's say, to the 50s, people were very much believers in what used to be called the tabula rasa theory. Do you know what that is? We all start off as empty boards. The fact is, a person's biological heritage influences who they are enormously. I'll just give you one example of this, and then we'll go on to the second factor. An example of that would be a child who's the child of two alcoholic parents. Even if that child is adopted at birth, has an 80% greater chance statistically to be an alcoholic. Did you know this? And the reason for them is the way their body absorbs alcohol is different than the way somebody else's body absorbs alcohol. So the first thing that makes you is your biology. Okay. The next thing that makes you is your environment. Everybody's environment is very specific and very unique. So even if you have two children who are brought up in the same home, siblings, they don't have the same environment. So I'll give you an example of what I mean. One is older, one is younger. So the older sibling was the one who turned the parents into parents. They got fresh new parents who didn't know what they were doing. The second child got experienced parents who are more confident. In addition to this, the family environment isn't the only environment to which a person is exposed. School, friends, literature, art, TV, media, all of these create a person's environment. So no two people have the same environment. So again, the first two factors that make you are your biology and your environment. Next one. The next one is what Rambam calls potentials. Everyone has different potentials. So when you say somebody is a natural musician, you don't mean that there they were on the labor table singing Aida. It means that if they're exposed to music, they'll pick it up and enjoy it more readily than somebody else will. So potentials are there. They may be developed or may not be developed. Okay, the next thing that makes a person themselves are choices. There are choices that we make in the course of our lives that open doors and close doors to the development of our personality from that point onward. So you give me an example of one of what I would call the irrevocable choices. Once you make this choice one way or the other, everything is different from that point on. How's getting married or not getting married to this person or to that person? Even if subsequently the person divorces, it's not the same as though they never got married. Their capacity to trust, to love, is different because of that choice. A woman could choose to go to Israel to study for a year or not. They could change or not change externally, but internally that's a door that once it's open doesn't leave you the same as it was before. Now, here's another thing, though, that you have to consider when you talk about the effect of choice making on the personality. The big choices, and I gave you two examples of big choices, are pre-made by small choices. So I want to illustrate this. The end of the war, 1945, how often were the trains going into Auschwitz, do you know? Every 8 minutes. Something to think about. There was an important Nazi on the platform. Sometimes it was Mengele, sometimes it was others. And he would direct some people to the right and some people to the left. How likely is it, if he's been doing this for years, and the trains are at this point coming in every 8 minutes, that he's going to change his mind and say, what am I doing here? Who am I to decide who lives, who dies? Is that going to happen? Is that going to happen? It's not going to happen. Let's go back to 1942, the first day he was there. Is it more likely to happen then? Yes or no?
Yes.
Yes. Is it very likely to happen then? No, because you wouldn't get to where he was in the Nazi hierarchy if it was very likely that you would say, I can't send any Jew to his death. Let's go back earlier. He joined the SS. If somebody would have told him the day he joined the SS and he got that nifty little SS tattoo under his arm, the day will come when you're going to be responsible for throwing babies in an oven. Would he believe them at that point? Maybe. Would he be willing to do it at that point? Maybe not. Maybe yes, because he did select SS, right? He could have said Luftwaffe, the Air Force. So let's go back a little further. He's just beginning Gymnasia, which is how you say high school in German. He's beginning Gymnasia, and he has to choose between Hitler Youth or Eagle Scouts. Now at that point, when he chose Hitler Youth, if somebody would tell him, you're going to end up being responsible for having babies burned to death, would he believe them? No. So there's always a point where a person has free choice, but that point is not when you're making the big choice, it's when you make small choices. So this factor in the development of our individual personalities is something that's made second by second, sometimes by our choice-making capacity, to the point that Maharal would say we give birth to ourselves. Last thing, the fifth and last thing that makes you different than the person you're sitting next to, is habit. Somewhere along the line, we develop habits of response. Those habits become part of our character. So I'll give you an example of what I mean. How many of you have ever had the great pleasure of taking a two-year-old shopping in the supermarket? Any of you ever had that great pleasure? Okay, so let's pretend that you're a naive young mother. This is your first child. She said, oh, I should take her to the supermarket. This is great mommy and me time. She'll learn colors and textures and shapes. So this is what, you're stupid. Okay, so this is what you think, this is what you think will happen in the supermarket. How do all shopping trips with two-year-olds to the supermarket end? They all have the same ending. Crying. She wants something that you can't give her, like a bottle of beer. Okay, and or she wants another cigarette to tear apart. Okay, you can't give it to her, so she ends up screaming hysterically in those cute little cars with the little seats for the babies. So she's like trying to throw herself out of the cart, pulling things off the shelf and screaming hysterically. Could this happen? Will this happen? That's how those trips end. So you're online, and the baby is throwing a fit, and the object of her desire is a big chocolate bar. Okay, so there's an older woman standing in back of you on the line, and she's saying nasty things about you to somebody else, like, these people have children, like animals. She can't even take care of her baby, okay? So could you picture yourself in desperation giving the baby the chocolate bar just to shut her up? Could this happen? Could happen. What? Yes, so please take whatever it is you left. Okay, so if that's what happens, okay, could you see if this pattern repeats itself sufficiently numerous times, the child is going to learn something. What will the child learn? Throw a fit, get chocolate. Okay? Now, if this pattern is repeated really enough, they've discovered the secret that will get them what they want in life to a large degree. Are there people who are 50 who when they want what they want will scream loud until they get it? Okay, that's called habit. Okay, clear? So just to review, there are five things that make you different than the person sitting next to you: your biology, your environment, your potentials, choices that you've made, and habits that you've developed. Okay, this is clear? So this is what makes you you. Okay, now, keep this image, but I'm going to take you to in another direction. Go back to your earliest memory. Go back as far as you could possibly go. Are you there? How far could you go back? Okay, so what do you remember? You remember your first day of kindergarten?
I guess probably just because of photographs.
Uh-huh. So maybe it's real, maybe it's not. Okay, what's your earliest memory?
Nursery.
You remember being there? Okay. Linda, what's your earliest memory?
Being embarrassed by saying this in front of my friends.
Uh-huh. How old were you?
Uh-huh,
okay. Can any of you go back even earlier? Okay. What? What could you remember?
Being
you remember being in the crib holding the bars? Yeah. Okay, so most people, if they put in effort, could remember back as far as somewhere between 2 and 3. And I'll tell you why we can't remember earlier than that. You know how on a computer, in order to call a file, you have to know the file's name? Okay, so the only way we could call up memory consciously is with words. So things that are filed away by picture and not word are almost impossible to recall consciously. But they're there. So you're there with your early memory? Yes? Okay. Were you you or were you me? You were you, right? So what I'm telling you, after having told you Rambam's definition of selfhood, is that there's an earlier self than that. So that self who you were at 2 or 3 or 5 was before a lot of the choices you've made, before a lot of the development of potential that you've experienced, before some of the habits became entrenched, but it was still you. You could see this? So we have a primitive you, and we have a conscious self. So Judaically, we're going to call them by different names. And I'm going to introduce one other self before we do that. There's also the self that has to do with physical experience and lives in the moment. So if I were to step on your foot, which wouldn't be nice, okay, and you say, "You are my foot!" Okay, now the self that's speaking there is really just body. It's not memory, it's not environment. Okay, you could see that? Okay. So we have the physical self, the conscious self, and the primitive self. We're going to call them nefesh, ruach, neshama. Nefesh is the physically oriented sense of self that we have instinctively. The word nefesh is related to the word nofesh, which means vacation in modern Hebrew. It's the aspect of the soul that rests, which is what nefesh means, against the walls of the body. So when you say, "I love music," the I that loves music is nefesh I. Okay, this is clear? Next, ruach. Ruach is the choosing self. I want this, I don't want that. I'll do this, I won't do that. I'll show her what she... Okay, got this? So that I, the choosing self, is called ruach. What does wind look like? Ruach literally means wind. What does wind look like? It's invisible. We only see its effect on other things. So if you look out the window and say, "I see it's windy," you didn't see the wind, you saw the trees move. Similarly, our choosing self is almost impossible to articulate, but we see its effect through the choices we make. Okay, clear? Okay, above that is the neshama, the subconscious spiritual self that yearns, that wants. So if you go back to your very early memory, what you wanted most then was connection. What you wanted was to feel significant, protected, secure. So from that perspective, we have neshama, ruach, nefesh, which is conventionally referred to, the three of them together, as naran. That's the self. So these, to get a concrete grasp on the self, we experience the neshama primarily through the mind, the ruach primarily through emotions, and the nefesh primarily through physical experience. So a question is, how do we feel about ourselves? So the Gemara tells us that when Hashem created the first human, he could have created an entire human population the way he did, let's say, an entire giraffe population or apple population. But instead he created a single human being, an individual human being, which if any of you like biological anthropology, you may be aware that a number of years ago they found a common ancestor to all. They found a common genetical code for the original ancestor. Okay, clear? Why did Hashem make one human? So the Gemara gives two answers. One is so intuitively everyone says to themselves, the whole world is here for me. It was all created for me. Now this isn't a conscious thought or a rational thought, but it's the source of our own sense of our significance. So you know how children say things that adults clearly think but won't say because it sounds so bad? So this once actually happened. One of my kids learned about nuclear warfare in third grade. She came home and said, you know what they told us? So I said, what? You know, like, there could be like a man and he makes, you know, like a bomb, and like they have a button, and if he presses the button, it goes off. Like, it goes off by like making a plane go somewhere. And then like it drops in the world and it like radiates, goes woo, yeah, and then everybody melts. Okay? So I was like appalled. Why did the teacher tell this to a third grader? So she should vote intelligently. What is happening? Why does the third grader have this information? So I was horrified, but you know what? She wasn't. You know, she's like totally cool. She's like circling my kitchen in her tricycle, like, and like, you know, everybody melts, and like it's like the eyeballs. They open up. And finally, I said, like, doesn't this bother you? You know, the idea of like the whole world ending in that way. And she said, no, it doesn't matter. So I said, what do you mean it doesn't matter? She says, if I'm dead, what does it matter? So she said it, but what? Subconsciously, everyone thinks like this. So from that perspective, nobody could envision a world without self. Rationally, yes. Subconsciously, no. The Gemara says something else, though. Why did God make one human? The answer is not only the one I gave you, but also in order that no person say, my original ancestor was a greater human than yours. We all come from a common ancestor, which is why on a gut level we also realize that every human life is significant. So we see ourselves as first amongst equals, but we also see every human as having a certain level of significance. So now our real question, and this is the question which the rest of the lecture will be devoted to, is what self-change about, and why would anyone change, and how would they change? So you could think, if I'm the most significant person in the world, or the one for whom the entire world was created, I should love and accept me as I am, on one hand. And on the other hand, we all tend to aspire to growth and movement. So why do we try to grow and change? What's this about? So it's about two things. First, we all know on a deep and instinctive level that the self has to struggle for its survival, that there are forces within us that drive us towards our own spiritual death. We all know this. So on some level, we know that we're embattled with self, fighting against who? Self. And we want to survive. So I have to define spiritual death. In order for this to be defined, let's talk about physical death. You give me a reasonable definition of physical death. If I step on an ant and I say it's dead, what does that mean?
Stops moving.
No movement. Anything else?
Can't do anything. No function.
No function. Not just no movement, but no function. So physical death means where the body loses all of its capacities to function and move. Okay, spiritual death means when the soul loses its ability to function and to move. We're wired to resist death. We resist physical death and we resist spiritual death. That's one thing to bear in mind. Next thing to bear in mind is that in Judaic thought, the verb to live is a relative term, not an absolute term, unlike in biology. So let me illustrate this to you. If I were to ask you, is this alive or dead? What's the answer? Is it alive or not? Is it or isn't it? No?
No.
No. Okay. In fact, if you said, yes, it talks to me, it talks to my best friend, we would wonder. Okay. Now, if you were to say, well, why don't you think it's alive? Anybody here thinks this is alive? No. You'd say, look, it doesn't move, it doesn't grow, it doesn't reproduce, it doesn't eat, it doesn't do any of the conventional definitions of change. But if you were to look at it under a powerful microscope, to the point where you could see its atoms, would you see movement or stillness? You'd see movement. Would you see reproduction and division? You would. So how come we don't see it moving, even though on an atomic level, and certainly on a subatomic level? Do any of you like that sort of thing? Did you ever see pictures of quarks on the move? It's incredible stuff. Okay, only much, much faster. Okay, how come we don't see this as mobile and moving? Now, what's the physical reason? It's all packed together. That's called density. Okay? It's so dense that we can't see it move. But it's alive. What keeps all those atoms going?
Energy.
Okay, where does... God, I know. Okay, whatever. Okay. Or force, as physicists would say. Okay? So force in Judaic language is divine will. So this in a certain sense is alive, and this that it receives force continually and constantly. And as it receives force, there's constant movement and change. Clear? Okay. Now let's compare this to a banana. Let's say I had a banana right here. Which is more alive? This MP3 or a banana? Banana. Okay, banana can do all kinds of things an MP3 can't do. It could grow. What else could it do?
Rot.
Tell me more. Could photosynthesize. Why is life just like so full? Okay. So we would call this more alive. Okay, clear? Now suppose, so here's the MP3, here's the banana. Right next to it, I pull out of my bag, I happen to have brought, let's say, a mouse with me. Could you imagine the kind of, like if I really, bang! Okay, let's say I have a mouse, I put the mouse right over here, I have the mouse in the little cage. Okay, what's more alive, the mouse or the banana? Mouse. What can a mouse do that a banana can't do? No? Move. Okay, see, hear, direct its own locomotion, experience primitive emotions such as fear, right? Banana. Okay, okay, now, let's say there's a person. Okay, so we would say a mouse is more alive than a banana, right? Okay? Now, a person could do much more than a mouse. What are some things that you could do a mouse can't do? You could articulate speech far more readily than a mouse, although there's some level of primitive communication that a mouse does. Okay, tell me more. You yap on, and it doesn't, that's it? Okay, higher cognitive ability, aesthetic sensitivity, the capacity for moral choice, yearning, connection, achievement. So we would say a human is more alive than a mouse? Yes, no? Okay, now here's where I'm leading you. Some people are more alive than others. Some people are more alive than others. What do you think that means? More open to change and to growth and to movement than others. So I'll tell you what a dead person looks like. Okay. No, I won't tell you what a dead person looks like. I'll tell you what to avoid. See yourself at 45. Don't see some random 45-year-old person. See yourself at 45. You there? Okay, what would you like your life to look like? If you could play the game any way you want, what would your life look like at 45? Okay. How old are your children at 45? Yeah, married and adult finished children. Okay. What else is on the page? You have a career. What would you like your career to be at 45? Okay, so you have a successful psychological practice. Okay? Okay, you're ready? So in order for you to be there, let's assume that for most of you, that may not be true, by the way, but let's say for most of you it's more or less that same picture. Married, children, career. How many of you would say that would fit the paradigm pretty much? It's not a bad picture. You would have achieved this primarily over 30 years. Could you see where this is so? Would it take 30 years to do this? To develop a career on that level? To have finished children? How many of you think would take a lot less? Not the finished children part. Okay. But the other part would take less. So let's go 35, let's go 30 years forward. 45, 55, 60. But it's not that, it's 55, 65, 70. What would you want to do in that next period, that next 30 years? You raise the grandchildren and their parents raise the grandchildren. You're killing off your kids? No. What would you want that next 30 years to hold? So I want to tell you, in the society in which we live, what's the answer? That's the answer. So for most people in our society, spiritual death takes place at around 40. You go on biologically, but nothing much is going on. Could you see where this is so? The Judaic vision is you don't stop living. Meaning the person who somebody is at 92 should be radically different and less than the person is at 93. So in order for that to happen, in order to not die at 40, 45, you have to have some idea of who you want to be and how you're going to get there. That's called spiritual growth, and that's why change is worthwhile. Because the alternative to growth is what? Is death. And a lot of people end up choosing death subconsciously without knowing that that's the choice they've made. In Pirkei Avot, there's this whole life calendar. Have any of you seen it? Well, you know, learn to read by 5. Learn Torah by 10. Married 18. Okay, Okay, keep going. What's the plan for 60? What's the plan for 50? Do you know? 50, counsel others. 60, develop your wisdom. So, okay, got it? It goes on. It ends at 100. At 100, be self-transcendent to the degree to which nothing in the world can tempt you any further. So the ideal is to keep on growing. Now we could talk about the difference between growth and death. People sometimes perceive growth as death. Why do you think they get those two very opposite concepts confused? So I'll tell you why. In order to be the new you, you have to stop being what? The old you. Okay, so let me illustrate this to you. Go back to your childhood, not to your earliest memory, just childhood. You may remember this or you may not. Somewhere in your childhood, somebody no doubt taught you how you could win every game of tic-tac-toe as long as you're the one who goes first. Okay, is this true? You could. Now, when you're a kid and someone shows you this, who maybe, let's say a good age for learning this is 7. When you were 7, this is like news to you. Yeah, I could do it. Like, okay, I'm going to go first. Okay. And you thought, gosh, now I'll play tic-tac-toe and I'll always win. I want to tell you something. As soon as you learn how to win, does your delight with tic-tac-toe get bigger or smaller? Smaller, to the point that nobody wants to play tic-tac-toe much after they learn the trick, right? You know, with people your age don't get that. Hey, what are you doing tonight? Let's have some tic-tac-toe, whatever. Okay, it's boring, it's banal, you don't want it. Okay, the trick to staying alive is being able to let go of where you've already been. Don't live the same day again and again. That's what growth's about. From a Judaic perspective, that's what life is about. One of the components that you have to have in front of you if you're going to have a plan for tomorrow instead of just reliving today. So there are two things that you need. One is self-awareness, which takes us back to what we learned from Rambam at the beginning of the class. Know who you are biologically, know who you are as a result of your environment. Remember what you've learned along the line, figure out your potentials, know your habits, and move them on to the next rung on the ladder. The next is to have a blueprint. You have to have a picture of the ladder. You have to have some idea of where you could go with who you are. Now, before I talk to you about the blueprint, I want to ask you, will any two people who are involved in maximal growth look exactly alike, at the end of the story? Yes or no? No. Everyone is taking those 5 components and using them to go further. So no two ladders look exactly alike. There's a reason I'm telling you this. I want to tell you a fear that people have. There are 2 basic fears, and then we'll start talking about root. One is, if I stop being the person I am today, I would have died. I'm telling you, no, you'll live. If you stay the person who you are today, you're dead. The other is, if I let go and I start walking forward, I'll end up being exactly like all of the other people who are going this route. I'll lose my individuality and become another cookie who was made by the cookie cutter. Do people think this? Do they or not? They do. So I want to assuage both fears. Staying where you are is a death sentence. Moving forward will never make you like anybody else. It will make you more yourself, not less yourself. The blueprint is the Torah itself. The Torah is very different than any other blueprint, and I'll tell you why. The way we envision things moves from our observational capacity. Torah takes us from a higher place than our own observation. So I'm going to tell you a story, and then we'll talk about roots. I'm taking too long with my stories, but I'll make this short. Do any of you know what the cargo cults are? This is fascinating stuff. Back in World War II, the American Department of Navy Intelligence foresaw that there might be real danger of the Japanese invading Australia. So in order to preclude a possible invasion, they wanted to station airmen on the islands near Australia, notably Papua New Guinea. Papua New Guinea, even today, is the most primitive spot on the earth. People still live in caves. Okay? So the psychologists in the Navy realized that they were just going to land airmen there by plane. What's likely to happen? Now, in order to figure out what's likely to happen, I want you to be there in Papua New Guinea. You're there, you're minding your yam field, just like you did yesterday. Now, I realized the people who were primitively developed in terms of technology aren't stupid. They just don't have MP3s, right? Okay, so you're minding your yam field, you hear a loud noise. In Papua New Guinea, does anybody ever hear a loud noise? No, there are no loud noises. You hear a loud noise, so it shakes you. You look up. What do you see? How would you interpret a plane? Big bird. Okay, this big bird is coming closer and closer and closer, and it's making this incredible noise. How would you feel about it? How would you feel, no?
Scared.
Now, the line that separates fear and hatred is a very fine line. You'd be afraid of it, and you'd want to defend yourself against it. It lands in your yam patch. Its belly opens. And are you ready? Hold on to your seats for this one. White human beings start coming out. Now, if you were living there, seeing a white human is like a flying saucer landing in your garden and you're seeing purple humans. Okay, clear? So the psychologists were afraid that they would kill the people immediately. So what did they do? They gave the airmen things to give the people. Mirrors, matches, and beads. In island society, beads are currency. Mirrors are fascinating. If you never saw yourself, a mirror is like amazing. In fact, some people, even if they do see themselves, can't tear themselves up, whatever. And matches, if you spend a lot of your day fire making, matches are amazing. Okay. The end of the war. The Department of the Navy realized no invasion took place. It's economically not worth it bringing the airmen back by plane, because the fuel between Micronesia and the United States is huge. So what they decided to do was to send a helicopter just to take the airmen and leave the planes there. As late as 1965, the people were still worshiping the planes. They wanted more matches, more mirrors, more beads, and they would pray to the plane, hoping that somehow new white men would come and distribute these goods. Okay, clear? I'm telling you this story for a reason. What do you think the reason is? This is true. The reason is that if all we have is our own observations, if that's all we rely upon, we get a very limiting picture. This is why all human devised systems ultimately take people far enough from ultimate truth that there's a moment of spiritual death. So because of this, the ladder itself, the blueprint itself, is the Torah. Why? Because that comes from a source above our conceptions. Now, I don't know you, so I don't know if you believe in the Torah's divinity or not. I'm going to assume that you do just for the sake of the class. If you don't, pretend you do for a moment. Now let's look at Rut. According to every law of logic, what should her life have looked like? She was a Moabite princess. Moab, in the primitive world, was a society that had two defining factors. Do you know what they were? Cruelty and promiscuity. Their entire history is replete with examples of extraordinary cruelty, even for the times, and extraordinary promiscuity, even for the times. Some of this has to do with biology and heredity and history. Lot, his daughters, the caves, the incest, some of you know the story that I'm referring to. Some of it has to do with the environment they created and choices they made and habits they developed. But that's what she grew up with. Do most people define the word normal in terms of the society in which they live? Okay. Is this a good definition of normal? No. In fact, is any definition of normal a good definition? No. All normal means is what you're used to seeing. Today, as we're sitting here, there's a civilization in Central Africa in which one of the tribes, I'm not making up this name, they're called the Uggs. Okay? The Uggs are hunter-gatherers. One of the things that makes their society very unique and interesting is that there's absolutely no physical violence, no murder. It's the only civilization that people have come across in anthropology that has no violence. But oops, they're not so perfect, because one of their little mishigaisim is that if somebody can't keep up with the pace of the trail, they abandon them. So it means if somebody trips, they're dead. If somebody gets old, they're dead. If someone has a handicapped child, the child will die. You understand this? So an Ugg society, is abandoning your parent normal? Sure. So don't make too much of normal. Normal, in fact, is often another word for what? Dead. Not moving, not thinking, not going on. Root decided not to be dead. Now let's move many steps in her story. How many of you are familiar with the Ruth story? Are any of you totally unfamiliar with the Ruth story? How many of you are unfamiliar with it? Okay, so I'm not going to retell the story. Suffice to say that the end of the story is that there are two traits that were really definitive for her. Do you know what they were? Kindness and modesty. Meaning she moved as far away from cruelty and promiscuity as a human being could possibly move. In the Ruth narrative, we find her kindness in this, that she left Moab after her husband's death, supported her mother-in-law Naomi in Israel by gleaning, by taking food from the fields. Extraordinary kindness with extraordinary sensitivity. For instance, she gave Naomi the right to apportion the food that she gathered to give Naomi some dignity. She made every effort to marry a man, Boaz, in order to spiritually redeem her late husband through a process called Hebam, which brought about reincarnation. Great kindness. Great modesty. She was recognized by the fact that when she would lean the sheaves in the field, she would bend her knees rather than her back in order to pick them up. What does that have to do with modesty? When you bend your back, your legs are exposed. When you bend your knees, nothing is exposed. Her sensitivity towards her privacy and her dignity, her unwillingness to share her body with anyone with whom she has no bond, developed to that point, which is far, far beyond the necessities of Jewish law. So there's a word we would call root. You know what word that is? Alive. So in the Torah it says, choose life. In the light of everything that we learned today, what do you think that means? Yeah. Choose growth. The worst choice you could ever make is death. Don't go there. Don't create a life where who you'll be in 5 years from now will be who you are today. In fact, the way you choose life is by what means? How do you choose life? The way to choose life is by having an inner map for your own growth. If you want to be alive, you have to say, here's how I am today. This is who I am biologically, in view of my environment, in consequence of my potentials and choices, including my habits. And here's who I'm going to be this time next year. This time next year, I want to be different. Does that mean you should all be the same? No. For one person, that will mean I want my Shabbos to be Shabbos as opposed to sometimes Shabbos. For another person, it'll mean I want my financial integrity to be in a different place than it is today. For somebody, everybody knows who they could be. The area of commonality is movement. The area of difference has to do with the five factors that we discussed at the beginning of the class. No two people's maps for growth are the same, and because of this, nobody can judge anybody else. Nobody is coming from the same place as anybody else. Nobody at the end of the story should look exactly like anybody else. But the area of commonality is that if we're not willing to doom ourselves to death, we have to grow. Okay, this is what I'm going to conclude with. I'm giving you 5 minutes for questions. Yeah? That's right. Integration is part of the growth process. Absolutely.
So, like, how do you determine when you're ready for the next level, or and is it considered like that's a whole new one?
No, integration is not the same as death. Integration is taking things in order to solidify them.
It's so,
it's absolutely part of growth, and it's a necessary part of growth. Mm-hmm. In terms of figuring out when is it enough integration, when are we ready for step two, there always has to be what I would call a little bit of spiritual tension. Okay? If there's no tension at all, then odds are you're not just integrating, odds are you're asleep. Yeah?
Physical death is something a person has a matter?
No, unlike physical death, which is pretty irreversible, okay? Sometimes, did I say always? Didn't say always. Sometimes people come out of spiritual death. Okay, the process of doing that, which could sometimes come from the inside, sometimes from the outside, is recognizing that one is indeed not growing, isolating the cause of their lack of growth, and making resolutions to change for the future. So this process is possible, and people have done it. The question, what could you do for another person? You could daven for them. You could say, ask Hashem, either in the formal tefillot, in the bracha for return, or the bracha for da'at, ask Hashem for that person, or in your own words. But in a general sense, you can't make somebody else's choices. You could just ask that Hashem give them experiences and desire to open their eyes. No more questions? Okay, going once. Yeah?
Do you have any practical suggestions for how people could actually take a step to grow? Because I think everybody wants to grow. I don't think anyone goes through life without wanting it, but it's hard to actually motivate yourself properly.
So what I would recommend strongly is there are two things that make growth concretely possible. One is learning. Without learning, it's very hard to grow. So what you should learn depends on what inspires you and what informs you. So there's not a uniform answer here. The other is having a mentor. It's very important to have a growth mentor, somebody who's a step ahead of you, who knows you and cares for you enough to help you move on. This could be a rabbi, it could be a teacher, it could be somebody in Partners for Torah. Going twice. Bye!
Oh,
okay.
You can't obviously work on everything at the same time, so how do you know like what area specifically focus on?
So that's a good question. The answer to that is you have to know yourself well enough to know if I do A, what will the next step be? There are some commitments you could make that are likely to make everything else more likely to move. So an example of that would be a commitment to keep Shabbos. Where if you keep Shabbos, that'll necessarily change your belief system enough that it'll, in the end, take you to saying brachas, to davening, to keeping other mitzvahs between man and God. Okay, clear? So you have to say, choose something, if you're moving towards something, that will grab in other things with it. Okay, Zehu. All the best.
Now, they have 6 samples that you point.